Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Atul Gawande is a practicing surgeon who also writes about medicine for The New Yorker. And his articles have legs. A 2009 piece he wrote about the out-of-control cost of healthcare was cited by President Obama while he was making the push for the ACA and passed around the West Wing. So Atul is concerned about the repeal of the law, and in particular, what happens if insurers can once again deny coverage of pre-existing conditions. He wrote about that recently in a piece called The Heroism of Incremental Care. You grew up in a family of doctors. Your parents were specialists, a pediatrician and a urologist, and you grew up with this all around you. And you yourself became a surgeon. I'd love to know why, since this piece kind of valorizes primary care doctors, I wonder why you decided to become a surgeon, and your parents were specialists, of course.
Well, it was there are a couple reasons. Number one was I think it suits my personality. I like problems you can solve in 3 or 4 hours, not in a lifetime.
When you were coming up as a doctor, was primary care considered kind of a dull thing, an ineffective thing?
Oh, yeah. Like, you know, all of the pressure was, you know, if you're smart, you know, how could you go into primary care? And at the time I was going through medical school, it was so easy to see what the impact was of surgery. Like, you go in an operating room, you see people save a life, and you said, wow, I want to be part of that.
So when was the inflection point? When was the moment at which primary care became something absolutely essential? You call it the heroism of incremental care. But was there a moment in time when things flipped?
Well, I would say we're kind of in the middle of that time now. It's only been in the last decade or so that it's been demonstrated that having a regular source of care from a clinician who knows you added years to your life and health in a way that simply seeing the best possible specialist you could find was not generating that. My son is an example. I tell the story of Walker, who has a congenital heart disease, a complex congenital heart disease. And the critical person in his life is his cardiologist. You know, he was saved by heroic rescue medicine when he, in 11 days of life, went into congestive heart failure. We didn't know why.
And it old is he now, Atul?
And now he's 21 years old.
Yeah, amazing.
And he was rescued and saved on that in those first 2 weeks from complete organ shutdown. Artificial arch of his aorta reconstructed and open heart surgery. But then the next 21 years has been all about controlling his blood pressure, being able to address some learning issues that come along with this condition, being able to monitor and catch when the repair now was becoming too small from his for his 6'1" tall body. And, you know, his cardiologist and the physician assistant who works with her have been paid a fraction of what that cardiac team who worked for a few days to save his life. But they have been equally important in many ways, you know, absolutely essential to his realizing the value of all of that heroic work done at 11 days of age.
So I'm lucky. I have a doctor I see once a year, if not more often, have all the normal tests, EKG, and all the pleasant and unpleasant tests that come with it. And then afterwards, he takes me into the office and we go through all the major things that can go wrong. And he sort of assures me that I'm doing the right thing in terms of exercise or a statin or whatever it is, all through the list. And if I'm lucky, I leave the office singing a happy tune. But I know in my heart, in this very big country, that very, very few people have a doctor like that or a medical circumstance like that. What is the range of circumstances out there in the country in terms of people seeing their doctors, not having access to doctors, costs? What are the big things that are the barriers to the circumstances that you're hoping for in your article and beyond?
Well, this is where I think it's so important because most people do not have a regular source of care from someone who knows them. And there are a variety of reasons for that. One of them has to do with the very issues we're debating right now around our national healthcare debate. You know, we have 19 states where the Affordable Care Act was not accepted by those states, by conservative states. And so you have 15, 20, 25% of the population there who do not have regular access to care. And one of the first things that people drop when they're short of money is having your regular clinician appointments and a routine relationship with a clinician goes out the window. You wait until the very last minute, until it's an absolute emergency, until you can't avoid it. And that's when things are often out of control. And then that's where you have, you know, major reduction in life expectancy and in health.
Now, I think we've been very disciplined and we haven't mentioned the name Donald Trump not once in this conversation yet, but that's about to end. Right now, the president, President Trump, declared that he was going to make good on his promise to repeal and replace. What were the flaws in your view of Obamacare, and what is your concern about what's happening now in Congress and the White House?
Well, the flaws, and the Republicans have hit on it, and they're not wrong about these flaws. Mitch McConnell pointed out, well, for all the 30 million who gained coverage, there's still 25 million who still don't have health care coverage. Number two, 43% of people who got a health plan on the exchanges under Obamacare have a $2,500 deductible or more and often can't afford to pay that deductible. So the subsidies aren't that generous. And so they're not wrong about those criticisms. The problem is the conservatives in the negotiations with the Democrats pushed hard to keep those subsidies low. It was conservative states that refused to accept Obamacare, and now we've come out on the other side. I think it would clearly be a fantastic thing for the health of the country that we repair and supplement what's there. I can see readjusting. You can't get there and also reduce taxes on everyone, which is the vow that Trump is making. He's promising everybody a magic bullet, and there are trade-offs here. And in a grown-up world, we would work our way through figuring out the trade-offs that we're willing to make and not willing to make. And this is so crucially important, because if they repeal without replacing or promising that a replacement will come, the danger is that the insurance market that we've got or the subsidies that we have for people could collapse.
Well, how is that not political suicide?
I think it is political suicide, and that the expectation of people, whether it's focus group polls or just talking to people back in my hometown in Ohio, the expectation is Trump wouldn't do that. Trump would not make my situation worse.
Why can't we get this right? This is just an enormous problem. I don't imagine that conservatives don't share the value of having people be healthy in the country. Where is the great disconnect, and why can't this be fixed more easily? Is it a matter of values, politics? What is it?
I think it's politics less than values. The political battle is over who's going to pay for it and how. And Obamacare, at the end of the day, was a tax increase. It was a significant tax increase on the wealthiest part of the spectrum in order to pay for health care that ended up guaranteeing coverage and providing coverage for 30 million people. And that was a major political trade-off. There were winners and losers. The winners were not only the 30 million people who got coverage, but everybody who might have a pre-existing condition in their future, that they had a system that they could turn to for care. But on the whole, those were the winners. And the losers were the people who paid the increased taxes, although they themselves were protected by this.
But you make the point that all of us, in a sense, have a pre-existing condition. It's called being alive. It's called facing mortality, if we can refer to one of your great books. And the conservatives have come up with this idea of risk pools. How does this work or not?
Right. So one of the things that you see conservatives trying to generate are alternatives to the ways that the current system that Obamacare has works for covering the people who have pre-existing conditions. And you're absolutely right. That is increasingly all of us, because between genomics and new kinds of data, we can predict more and more who is going to have what kind of condition. The risk pool approach is to say, you know what? Let's not require that insurers cover pre-existing conditions and have an individual mandate, but instead say, look, if you keep your insurance coverage continually, then insurers have to cover your pre-existing conditions. But if you have a gap in your coverage and you can't afford now the coverage of insurers who may raise your rates if you had a healthcare problem during that time, we'll create risk pools that'll pay for you. It's basically saying the government will take care of some of the sickest people in the system. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You know, 5% of the population accounts for 50% of the healthcare costs. And if you took the people who are chronically ill that the insurers are reluctant to cover and said, let's cover them through a government insurance pool, I think that's actually could be a good thing. It would lower the insurance costs for other people. Here's where it goes wrong is that the risk pools that we've had at the state level have been ones that often have a six-month period of pre-existing condition exclusions themselves. They have caps as low as $75,000 total. They have very steep premiums, usually up to 250% of what the regular costs are for anybody else. And so the result is people didn't often sign up for the coverage. Now imagine if we said, look, let's take these people who are high risk, that are uninsurable in some sense, put them in Medicaid or Medicare.
Right.
That would be a way of putting them in a risk pool. And why create a whole new program when we have these other places to put them?
Do you have any optimism when it comes to healthcare and the Trump administration?
Well, two things. To me, Trump is so unpredictable. Basically, the existence of Trump as a decision maker is just, it's widened the range of possible outcomes that could have tremendous damage and really roll back gains that have appeared. On the other hand, if there were a plan that passed that was a quote-unquote repeal, but it won't take action until we've replaced Obamacare and put that date off into the future. I could see that could get passed. And the reality is there's no agreement among conservatives about what replacement is. And so in the meantime, they'll sign lots of waivers to allow the 19 states with conservative governors who didn't take Obamacare to now accept the program. And you could ironically be in a situation where I said again, there's a wide range of potential outcomes. One of those outcomes could weirdly enough be that there is an increase in coverage because conservative governors start opening the gates to letting people have coverage paid for by the federal government.
Atul, thank you so much.
Thank you. This is fun, as much as it is painful.
All the best. Atul Gawande practices surgery at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and he's a staff writer for The New Yorker.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.